This is a production of Cornell University.
My name is Nick Van Wall. I'm the director of the Einaudi Center, which is sponsoring this event. I want to welcome Professor Lowell Delpour, who's come from Paris to participate in today's event. I want to say that we had invited Sonar Gapchai as well, and as of, well, as of 25 minutes ago, we're not sure where he is. There appears to have been a problem with the plane ride here from Philadelphia, and we apologize. So we've had to kind of scramble and try to come up with a slightly alternate kind of framework for this. I think we'll do the following. I'm gonna talk for just a second. Then the moderator will moderate. Professor Delcour will talk a bit at greater length, and then we'll open it up. And I guess the good news is that you all can participate much more actively and hopefully take the role of Dr. Gapchai in this debate. Okay, so this debate is part of our project, Getting to Know Europe, Ithaca and the European Union, which the Einaudi Center is pursuing in collaboration with the Institute for European Studies. I want to thank the Institute for all of its work on the different events that we've been able to hold this fall. This is also part of our foreign policy initiative. We are hopeful that debates can be on foreign policy issues of the day can be a regular part of the. Of our programming and are currently at work on another such event for the spring term. And that's basically the end of my role. Let me introduce today's moderator. Chris Anderson is a professor in the government department here at Cornell. He teaches courses on comparative European politics and conducts research on the micro foundations of democracy and political economy. He holds a PhD from the Washington University of St. Louis, and he studied also at the University of Cologne in Germany and Virginia Tech University. Chris, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Nick.
Now we'll stand over here because I have a job to do.
No,
you will do it? All right, then I'll stand over here to introduce our speaker. Thanks, Nick. I'm very pleased to welcome to the Cornell campus Dr. Lowell Delpour, who is, as Nick was saying, a researcher on the European Union and who teaches at Sciences Po. And those of you who do political science know what Sciences Po is. It's a leading research university in the social sciences in Paris. Let me tell you a little bit about Lowell, who will get a couple more moments to take a breath before she has to speak. She has written and taught extensively on the EU's external relations, including the EU enlargement process, which is, of course, the topic of tonight's discussion. She's also worked on the European neighborhood policy and EU-Russia relations. She received her PhD from Sciences Po, I believe, and her dissertation was on EU-Russia relations. But she's also very active beyond the world of academia. She's worked extensively as an advisor and trainer in various capacities to train civil servants for various European agencies and educational organizations, and that includes the Bruges College of Europe, the French National School of Administration, and the Swedish Development Cooperation Agency. She's a political scientist by training, as am I, and we're very sorry to miss the other speaker tonight, who is a historian by training, but I think between us and the crowd here tonight, we might be able to lend a historical perspective as well. So I'm very, very pleased to introduce Laure. What we'll do is slightly different from what we had originally planned. Laure will take about 20, 25 minutes, I believe, to present. We were originally going to have some comments from me. I will ask maybe a couple of questions, and then we can open it up for the audience. So here we go, Lowell Delpour.
Thank you.
to turn it on? No. Okay. So first of all, let me thank the Cornell University and the Edondi Center and Nick van der Waal for inviting me here. And I want also to thank Heike Michelsen for her precious help in organizing these visits. My speech today will focus on Turkey's accession to the European Union, but as seen from a European perspective. So I will address today three key questions linked to the Turkish accession process. First, the evolution of the European Union's position vis-à-vis Turkish accession and the current official line of the European Union. Then, the kind of hidden agenda beyond and behind that official European Union line, the reasons which make Turkish application so specific for the European Union, and the reasons which create divergences among European Union actors. And finally, the impact of Turkish application on the European Union integration process. So first, a short insight into the history of Turkish application. The key lesson to be drawn from that short history is that Turkey expressed its interest for being associated to the European community almost since the community was created in 1957. And such interest was expressed before countries like the United Kingdom, for instance. So in 1959, Turkey applied for association to the newly created European Economic Community. And the other silent feature when looking back to the past is that in the early 1960s, the prospect of a Turkish membership was explicitly foreseen by the European Community. And for instance, you can see that in the association agreement signed in 1963, aiming at bringing Turkey into a customs union with the economic community and to eventual membership. And the preamble explicitly provides that efforts undertaken by the people of Turkey will then facilitate Turkey's accession to the community. And indeed, at that time, it seemed it was quite natural in the context of the Cold War to foresee Turkey's accession insofar as Turkey was a strategic ally of the Western Bloc and a member of NATO, like the other six founding states of the European Community. So basically, what happened afterwards? What happened to Turkish application? Well, as a matter of fact, it simply disappeared from the top priorities of the European Community because of the upheavals in Central Europe and because of the end of the Cold War. So in the 1990s, the European Community focused on its own internal integration process. It transformed into a European Union in 1993. It also launched a process of economic and monetary union leading to the creation of the euro. And it also launched a process of political union leading to a common foreign policy. And also, immediately after the end of the Cold War, it engaged into a wide-ranging process of enlargement to former Soviet satellites, including the design of a strategy and tools which were tailor-made to the needs of Central Europe. So even though a customs union was finally created 30 years after the association treaty, between Turkey and the European Union, there was very little progress in the relations with Turkey until 1999. And indeed, 1999 is a turning point for Turkish application. At that time, the European Council in Helsinki decided to grant Turkey the official candidate status. So that's a kind of first step into towards membership. And that new status allowed to adopt an accession partnership, which is basically a roadmap for accession to the European Union. And a few years later, in October 2005, based upon a positive assessment of the European Commission, negotiations for Turkish accession started at the same time as Croatia. So basically, we are now standing here. The last step will be the closure of negotiations and the signature of the accession treaty to be approved by all EU member states and by the European Parliament. So the decision of granting that official candidate status reflects a new official European line regarding Turkey's accession. And that new line is based upon a strict application of EU accession criteria. So as a matter of fact, the European Union has turned Turkey into a candidate like the other candidates, which was not the case before. So let's have a look at the EU's accession criteria and also at Turkey's record in fulfilling them. In the early 1990s, the European Union gave for the first time a formal definition of the conditions to be met for joining. And those conditions are known as the Copenhagen criteria. And they were designed in the light of enlargement to Central European countries. So you have a first set of criteria, political criteria, such as stable institutions which guarantee democracy, rule of law, respect of human rights and protection of minorities, and then economic criteria. And you can see that those criteria were specifically designed for Central European post-communist countries. So a functioning market economy and a proven ability to face competition within the European Union. And finally, a third set of criteria is the adoption of the acquis communautaire, that is the laws and, legal text decided and drafted by the European Union, and the ability to fulfill the obligations stemming from European Union membership. So in fact, before the Copenhagen criteria were designed, the only condition to join the EC was political. And you can see that from the examples of Spain, Portugal, and Greece that joined after the collapse of dictatorships. Now about Turkey's current record regarding the implementation of those criteria. Well, it is rather positive. According to the report which was just issued by the European Commission a few days ago, unlike Central European countries, the economic criteria are not such a big deal for Turkey. And Turkey has also achieved substantial progress in the political area. But at the same time, Turkey needs to progress in a number of human rights related areas and issues, for example, cases of torture, for example, also maybe an excessive influence of the army over intellectual and political life. And also Turkey needs to develop further legal approximation in specific areas, legal approximation to the laws of the European Union. However, beyond the formal criteria, there is a kind of hidden agenda, and the Turkish application raises a number of specific issues upon which the European Union has adopted quite different positions. The first issue is the recognition of Armenian massacres of 1915 as a genocide. So tensions arise with member states having recognized the Armenian massacres as a genocide, for example, France. The European Parliament and the European Commission have called to an open debate between Armenia and Turkey, but they have also made it clear that the recognition by Turkey of the Armenian genocide is not a condition for joining the European Union, and that was stated quite recently by the European Parliament. So it is not part of the set of political criteria for joining the Union. The second issue of on the agenda of Turkish accession is the possible intervention of Turkey in northern Iraq against PKK. And here again, well, the European Union supported Turkey through condemning, like the US, the PKK as a terrorist organization. And it also expressed its understanding for Turkey's concern, while calling at the same time to a political solution. However, the third issue and the key issue, which is not negotiable for the European Union, is Cyprus. Cyprus has been a member state of, I mean, Greek Cyprus has been a member state of the European Union since 2004. And on the one hand, Turkey is committed to a settlement of the Cyprus problem under the auspices of the United Nations. But on the other hand, it does not implement vis-à-vis Cyprus the additional protocol to the association agreement, that is the protocol dedicated to the EU new member states. So there is a kind of discrimination by Turkey among EU member states, and that is not acceptable to the European Union. As a consequence, in November 2006, the Commission recommended to partially suspend negotiations with Turkey due to the lack of progress on the Cyprus issue. Now, another part of the hidden agenda behind the official line supporting accession, if Turkey fulfills, of course, the criteria, there are huge differences vis-à-vis Turkey's membership among EU member states. On the one hand, we have member states favoring Turkish membership. For example, the new member states, for example, the United Kingdom. On the other hand, we have hardliners opposing strongly Turkey's accession, like Austria or France. And those countries, and also the German CDU political party, suggested building a privileged partnership instead of accession. However, and that is quite interesting, member states' positions are also subject to evolution. And the best example of that is provided by Greece. Greece is now one of the biggest supporters of Turkish accession to the European Union after having strongly opposed it. And France has also now quite a softer discourse with President Sarkozy recently stating that France would not oppose the resuming of negotiations with Turkey. It should be noted that the European Commission is instrumental in trying to bring together member state position, and it does so through sticking to a technical assessment of the Turkish application. Now, what are the key factors shaping perceptions and position vis-à-vis Turkish accession? Differences among member states are structured along three main lines. First, economy. The Turkish accession, on the one hand, can be seen as a chance for the European Union, as an opportunity of integrating a large and dynamic market. On the other hand, it is also seen by opponents as a future financial burden to the European Union, especially for correcting imbalances with Turkey under the regional policy of the European Union. The second factor explaining European perception is Turkey's size and demography. If Turkey joined today the European Union, then it would be the second largest member state, just after Germany. And that would imply huge changes in the current decision-making system, with, for example, a new balance of votes within the European Council, but also a new balance of deputies within the European Parliament, a new balance also within the European Commission, a new budget, and so on. Of course, a related fear is Turkey's religion and the fear of a Muslim-led Europe. And that is quite salient in countries like France and Austria. And finally, Europe is also afraid of a flow of Turkish Gastarbeiter, of Turkish immigrants, and that was also the case with Central European countries, and that didn't occur. A third line along which EU positions are structured relates to international relations, and that is less visible maybe. Countries opposing Turkish accession argue that it would bring the European Union much closer to unstable areas and to conflicts, for example, well, Syria, Iraq, Iran, but also Caucasus countries and conflicts, Chechnya. On the contrary, other member states see Turkish membership as a chance, as an opportunity to strengthen the European Union's international influence. Beyond perception, what is the expected impact of Turkish accession to the European Union, to the European integration process? And my key point here will be that Turkey's application is a kind of mirror of Europe's own dilemmas, and it raises three crucial challenges to the European Union. The first challenge is about EU's identity. What does being European mean? With Turkish accession, the European Union is faced with the need to define its own identity. And, of course, to go beyond the treaties, which provides that any European country that respects the principles of the European Union may apply to join. So what is European? The problem for the European Union is the lack of valid criteria for defining itself. First, geography does not help. You have countries in Europe which are not part of the European Union, for example, Switzerland, for example, Norway. You have also, well, regions outside Europe which are part of the European Union, for example, former French colonies. And finally, the eastern borders of Europe are not clearly delimited, so it is quite difficult for the European Union to base its own identity on geographical grounds. Because, for instance, it would include a part of Turkey, the small part of Turkey being in Europe, and exclude the other one, the biggest one. History does not help neither, because linking the European Union identity to history, to European history, would lead to the inclusion into the European Union of countries which played a major role in European history. Of course, Turkey, but also, for example, Russia. And finally, there was a debate around the Constitution, the Constitutional Treaty, about the validity of religion as the basis of European identity. For example, countries like Poland favored a reference in the Constitution to the Christian roots of Europe. But it was finally decided to mention only a religious inheritance, because, for example, Islam is a part of European history as well, and it is also a key religion in several countries, for example, in Bosnia and also in Albania. So the only valid criterion to define the European Union's identity is political, that is, the compliance with democracy, rule of law, and the political criteria of accession, and also the willingness to join the European Union. And of course, Turkey cannot be rejected on that ground. Turkey raises a second challenge to the European Union, and that is the need for delimiting its borders. So where does the European Union end? Where do we stop? Since we defined the European integration as a political process, it has to be effective, an effective process, a manageable process. And the EU is about to incorporate new member states and to become a kind of monster with 35 states in. So Turkey is not by far the only candidate knocking at the door. We have Croatia and former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia, which also started negotiations, and then Serbia, Bosnia, Montenegro, Albania, that are considered officially as candidates, as potential candidates. But there are also other countries that have no official status and that are willing to join. We have Moldova, and especially we have Ukraine. Even before the Orange Revolution, Ukraine had adopted a national program of legal approximation for approximating its laws to those of the European Union. We have also Georgia that is now undergoing times of trouble. So we have the risk of an ever enlarging union with more over 40 members, non-manageable. And therefore, last year, the European Union decided to define a new accession criterion, and that is its own absorption capacity. And that criterion would strictly depend upon the European Union and not upon the candidates. But at the same time, Turkish accession will make it very difficult for the European Union to reject Ukrainian or Georgian applications. The third challenge raised by Turkey's application is the need to build a vision to define a project for European integration. Over the last 50 years, the European Union integration process has been progressing through pragmatism, the so-called money method, a pragmatic method. And such a method favored major achievements, but it has also major shortcomings, one of those being the so-called democratic deficit of the European Union. So as a matter of fact, fears of Turkey's accession are also linked and reflect rejection by European citizens of the European Union's own shortcomings. And that was quite clear in the case of France at the moment of the vote against the constitution. Furthermore, divergences around Turkish accession also reflect different visions of the European Union integration. So Turkey's application requires the European Union to clarify its own final objectives. What do we want to get out of European integration? Is it a single market like the UK favors? Or is it a new political actor? The European Union has therefore to build a vision of its own future. And it's no coincidence if Turkey's accession, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the constitutional treaty, are parallel processes. So my final words, what are the concrete prospects for Turkish accession? Turkey has still a long way to go before fulfilling accession criteria. Last week in Brussels, the Turkish Minister of Economy mentioned 2014 as a possible date for membership. But 2020, which is the beginning of the next EU financial perspectives, is much more likely. A second option, and that would create a precedent in the European Union's history, is non-accession. Non-accession following the end of negotiations, either through the failure of negotiations or through the rejection of the accession treaty by one member state or several. And as a matter of fact, opinion polls show that 48% of EU citizens are against Turkey joining the European Union, while only 39% are in favor. And several member states, like France, for example, already announced there would be a vote for the accession treaty for Turkey. Also, we have to think beyond Turkish accession. If we take the Commission's, the European Commission's official line, what the Commission is currently doing, that is depoliticizing Turkey's application, that helps building compromises around technical issues. But at the same time, it is a way out of the key issues facing the European integration process. So designing a political vision for European integration is a precondition to be fulfilled by the European Union to make future accession successful. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Laura. So my job is to ask a couple of stimulating, provocative questions. I hope I can do that. But before I get to the questions, I was going to emphasize a couple of things that Laura did say, and to bring them home. Since we are in the United States of America, a country that has grown over the years through the accession of member states, and at some point thought it was done by hitting the Pacific Ocean and then continued by incorporating Hawaii eventually, and then we may not be done, who knows. I think to Americans, Americans can sort of innately relate to this question of growing or an ever larger and ever growing union in a very specific way. One of the things that strikes me about the European Union and the project is that what an amazing project it really is. What an unusual project it is. It's a story with a storyline, but a very uncertain outcome. And I think the membership application of Turkey is a really a critical part of the story, because it really forces the Europeans to think really, really hard about who they are and who they want to be. And to think in both in practical terms, but also in very idealistic terms about what it is that we mean when we say Europe or the European Union. So I really like this dilemma. I really like this topic because it forces conversation, and it forces a discussion, and it forces a debate both among the Europeans, within the European Union at different levels, but it also forces a debate within Turkey. I know we have some people here from Turkey. This is also a very contentious topic within Turkey, or a topic certainly that you will hear people talk about. Are we all right? Excellent. Okay. So this operates on, at two levels, really. In a way, to summarize some of the questions here, is the question is how will the accession of Turkey change Europe or change the EU part of Europe? And the other part of it is, though, is how the EU will change Turkey, and what kind of Turkey will it produce through accession. So for me, part of the question is, part of the debate we're having is about whether Turkey will join the EU. And the other part of the debate is when it might conceivably join the EU. And I'm not entirely sure that we know what the question is in that regard. And I was hoping that Laura could maybe take a moment to talk about who in Europe is talking about the whether and who in Europe is talking about the when. From your presentation, it struck me that the people in Brussels are talking about the when. They're talking about the technical criteria and the negotiation and the compromise and the accession and so on. They're focused on fairly technical details, as they want to do. But it strikes me that a lot of Europe is talking about whether. Maybe not all of Europe, but certainly if you go to Austria, or if you go to France, or if you go to Germany, you'll find, or Luxembourg, you'll find a lot of people asking the whether question. So that was the first general comment I had, and the first question I had. And the second one is, since we are in the United States, why should Americans care? Why do we need to know? Is it in our interest that Turkey become a member of the European Union? Is it in our interest to have a member state of the European Union that borders on Iraq in this post 9/11 world? Or maybe is it not in our interest? If it is in our interest, what is it that we can do that to shape the outcome that we desire? So if you could take a couple of moments to talk about those issues, that'd be great. And then I'll take questions from the floor.
I think you are quite right to say that people in Brussels are talking about the when, because in every issue they are talking about the when. Because first it's closely linked to the political nature of the European Commission, for which time is a strong constraint. The European Commission has very little resources, and so it's pretty much constrained by time. But beyond that, it's also a choice, a political choice by the European Commission to focus on technical issues, and that stems from the history of the European Union, because the first political projects focused on, for example, defense policy, so high politics. You had Communauté Européenne de Défense, European Defense Community, in 1954, which was rejected by the French Parliament. And so the first attempt to unite European peoples was a failure. So it led the European Commission and European institutions to abandon high politics for a while, at least for three decades, and to focus on purely technical matters. And of course, I tried to show in my presentation that focusing on technical criteria, objective criteria, is also a way of escaping the true questions, the true issues. And of course, there's a growing feeling among European countries that accession enlargements are being made, well, without European citizens. And obviously, that was the case for enlargement to the 10 new member states. There was no consultation of European citizens. And the rejection of the constitutional treaty in France, in the Netherlands, was also protest against, well, that past enlargement and that way of doing by the European Commission. Regarding the US position, I see no reason why the US should be against the enlargement to Turkey. It is rather a guarantee of stability for the United States, and it is also a guarantee of having another, well, an ally or a friend struggling in unstable areas. But maybe you have different point of views.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. There's a question up there. I will start taking questions.
Government department. Since this was supposed to be a debate, I wanted to start the debate immediately by countering the point on the US. And it seems to me you could also argue that the US should have no interest in having Turkey getting into the European Union, since recently Turkish-American relations haven't been very harmonious. If you look at the position that the Turkish population generally has towards the US, I think only in Palestine you find a lower approval rating. There are also some Americans that feel probably some unease about a potential competitor in the European Union. Now, if this potential competitor, if Turkey really joins the European Union, as a member, it would probably deprive the US from an option of playing either with Turkey or with the European Union. In other words, it would lose a certain option in its foreign policy, and if the European Union should oppose the US on certain matters, economic or whatever, related to the Iraq war and so on, things would probably become even more difficult for the US. So I think you could also argue, I mean, the US could just be against Turkish membership just as well.
There's an interesting assumption in your speech, that is that Turkey's accession will strengthen the European Union. And that's not sure from the political point of view. And especially taking into account the current complexity of the decision-making system. So we just agreed on new modes of, well, new votes, new modes of decision-making, and it has been a struggle for the last 5 years. So I'm not sure if Turkey joins that it will strengthen the European Union, and maybe the problems will not come from Turkey, but from other member states. For example, currently Poland is quite problematic regarding the decision-making system. But again, I'm not sure the US sees Europe as a competitor. And this is also the UK position. We have to get a wider union in order to have a weaker union. So maybe US support of Turkey's accession is in the same line of thinking.
Yes, we have two hands up first here and then
jump up in. This is a hard one, but it needs to be said.
Why do you think that when anyone around the world starts to discuss the Armenian genocide and the possibility of recognizing that there was in fact a genocide rather than a civil war, and that there are still people who are alive who saw it firsthand, there's documentation of it, that somehow Turkey gets defensive and starts to make, for a better word, I would know, threats of cutting off things and bringing their diplomats back. And are they willing to review the documents and that might point to the fact that there was, in fact, a genocide rather than a civil war?
That should be a question to Dr. Chapter. I will try to answer. I'm not sure there has been some progress in Turkey about the recognition of the genocide. And in fact, also many European countries, many member states are quite critical of the European Union's not taking into account that particular issue as a criterion for Turkish accession. I think the European Union, what the European Union is currently trying to do is to call for a real debate in Turkey, which, as far as I know, has not taken place so far. Of course, there have been some debates in Turkey, but not involving, as far as I know, but I'm not sure about that, for example, Armenian historians. And that's what the European Union, the Commission and the Parliament are trying to get out of Turkey without making it a condition, because...
That could not be a condition if we are trying to promote democracy around the world. How can we just allow that to be part of our past, knowing that it's going to be part of our future? We accept the future genocides if we allow that to exist without being acknowledged.
We had a debate yesterday around that issue. And again, there is a legal definition of genocide, which was created after the Armenian genocide. And I think one of the issues for Turkey is also the validity, the scientific validity of the word genocide. Does it really apply to the massacres which obviously took place in Turkey vis-a-vis Armenians? Some member states of the European Union clearly decided that it applies, but as far as it remains a painful and open question in Turkey, the European Union cannot do anything else but calling to a debate. I mean, making it a condition would not be a solution, because you have to think also about other potential member states that experienced recent genocides, for example, Serbia. So you have to be careful. And maybe the decision of calling it a genocide should not be taken by the European Union, but under the auspices of the United Nations. And afterwards, then it could become a condition, but it has to be scientifically or legally defined as a genocide on an international basis.
Okay. There's another question. The gentleman right behind you.
I wonder if it's possible to link the wind and the weather as follows. Your final slide pointed out something we know, that we're talking 2014 or even 2020, because there are many chapters and this is a difficult negotiation. It seems to me that some of the current discussion takes place on the premise it's going to happen tomorrow, the mention of Iraq, for example. By next 13 years, for example, there'll be a new demography, a new population in Turkey. The demographic decline in Europe will probably not reverse itself, so the question of labor mobility becomes important. There's some indication that the Turkish economy and middle class is growing, and I think you may have, and there's some really faint signs, some addressing the cross time of the Armenian issue and some of the other issues that might stick in the craw of Christian Europe, the issue of the scarf. And there'll be new Europeans by 2020, some of whom are just being born for them. So I'm just wondering if your sense, or if this is discussed, that by 2020, labor, cultural transformation, etc., transform the whole political and economic and demographic environment under which these questions will be debated.
So if the when is put off,
then the weather may answer itself, of course.
I'm quite sure that's what the commission is relying on.
That's so, the gamble.
Yeah, probably. And it is also a good way of escaping, again, a real thinking, a real reflection, critical reflection on the purposes of the European integration process. And in my opinion, this is quite risky, because it widens the gap between the European Union and its citizens. A lot of people within the European Union are wondering, well, what do we want? Where are we going? And also a question which was never raised before, what are we doing together? So just after the war, of course, World War II, there were strong incentives for bringing together peoples of Europe. But now peace is a kind of habit. You can get used to it. So there's no longer motivations or incentives to go on together and also to bring in other people.
Can I just add to that? The generational issue is an interesting one that you raise, sort of what happens with the passage of time. I would add to that the generation of Europeans that formed sort of the original core of the European Union was a generation of people who had experienced the war, or two wars, as children or as adults, and I think they had a really strong personal commitment to moving this forward in a particular direction. And that generation is disappearing, both sort of among political leaders. If you look at who Sarkozy is or who Merkel is and these people who are involved in a lot of these decisions, they're not people who remember the war. They weren't born when the war ended. And so I think for them personally, it doesn't hold the same kind of connection, emotional sort of bond that it does for leaders today who are playing a different game, I think, in that sense.
Same for the Cold War.
Uh-huh, right.
You have teenagers or children who have never experienced the Cold War, the fear of USSR and so on. So there's no incentive to struggle for Europe.
Right. There's a hand up over here.
Yeah, I would like just to follow on that. Among 48% of the US, EU citizens, do they just have a lack of interest, or is it a fear? What is the major reason why they say no?
In the case of Turkey, obviously it's fear. Fear of a Muslim Europe, fear of immigrants flows, as I said. To a certain extent, fear of economic competition, fear of getting closer to conflict areas, and also resentment against the European Union itself for not being associated to the decision-making process and for being, well, left aside from the previous enlargement wave.
What's interesting about the question, that the percentages that you mentioned is, I dug this up before the talk, I thought this might come up. The question actually asks, once Turkey complies with all the conditions set by the European Union, would you be in favor or against the accession of Turkey to the European Union? So once they've done their homework, once everything's okay, they're behaving well, everything is as it should be, are you for or against? And 48% say against, and 39% say for. That's quite a strong number. One of the things to keep in mind, though, is that there's a lot of what we call in survey research non-attitudes having to do with Turkey and enlargement generally, the European Union in general. There are a lot of people who tend to say, I really don't know, I can't give you an answer. Those are quite sizable percentages in most of the surveys. So these are not cast in stone, I would argue, but they're certainly indicative of what's happening right now. When you ask Europeans, do you think it's more in the favor, is it in Turkey's interest, the EU's interest, or both, that Turkey join, for instance? The vast majority of Europeans say it's in Turkey's interest, predominantly, to join the European Union. And a very small percentage says it's primarily in the EU's interest. When you ask Turks who they think benefits from Turkey joining the European Union, what you'll find is that many people don't have an opinion. But more people say that the EU will benefit from Turkey's entering the European Union than say that it's primarily Turkey that will benefit. I think the numbers are 30% saying it's primarily the EU that will benefit, and about 10 or 12% say it's primarily Turkey that will benefit.
There is a widespread feeling in the European Union that enlargement benefits only candidate countries and not the European Union. And this is linked to the fact that peace is not, well, anymore an issue in Europe. So people cannot see any incentives for bringing, for example, Bulgaria or Romania in. And that was already the case for Central Europe, not only for Turkey.
Yes, there's a hand back there. Yes.
Hi. I have a very hypothetical question. So if tomorrow morning the EU tells Turkey to remove the headscarf ban to join the EU, do you think the Turkish government would reverse the ban? Or
I don't think the EU will ask.
The government is trying to do its homework.
I'm quite sure the European Union will not have such a requirement, so I cannot answer that question. No. It was not requested from Bosnia, from Albania, from... No. This will not be a requirement for sure.
Yes. Yes, the lady right there. Yes.
I wish to point out the discount is not.
Sorry, I cannot hear you.
I wish to remark that Giscard d'Estaing, perhaps 10 years ago, said that if Turkey gets into the EU, that's the end of the EU. And this really opened the floodgates to all of the sentiments, resentments, however you want to think of it there. And Angela Merkel has said that this will not happen on her watch. Do you care to comment on that? Is Giscard d'Estaing still out there? Has he changed his mind? Or does Sarkozy have a different opinion on it? Or?
As I said, well, leaders' opinion and member states' positions can change. And over the last month, for example, for France, when he was a candidate and when he was after his election, President Sarkozy had a different position, but the discourse changed. When he was a candidate, he was really a hardliner against Turkey. And afterwards, when he became involved into the European Union negotiation process, he understood that he had to be more cautious about it. So there are a lot of factors which can bring member states' position to changes. For instance, well, other candidate countries have an impact. For instance, international events have an impact. If there is a war on Iran, for example, that will have an impact. And so on.
So you have about the two differing Africa visions on the European Union, the Anglo-Saxon very loose market marketplace, and the more continental idea of creating a more federal and political unity. And Turkey seems to embody, in fact, this crisis in identity, because right now, having Turkey entering the European Union would be, I'm sorry, President Zimmerman, but a victory for America and the British in crucially weakening the political union of the European Union. Do you think it would be possible, first of all, to bring the institutions at a level to which it could, a level of political integration that would allow the European Union to integrate Turkey and still have a political unity? And furthermore, would it be possible to go into a two-track Europe, you know, up at the vitesse, where you could integrate Turkey in the sort of vast market area, and then keep all the countries, like Turkey at first, and Great Britain, because it never wants to touch continental Europe too much, and at the same time, have a very strong political Europe inside Europe, sort of double European Union. Sort of be a solution to the contradiction of the Turkey and the European Union.
I'm not sure it would be a double European Union. It would be a triple or more. But your questions are closely related, because there's already no political unity within the European Union, and you can see that from the fact that some countries, and especially among new member states, Poland, not to mention it, veto the majority's decisions. So, for example, there is a new agreement to be signed with Russia, and Poland has decided to put its veto, so that's over. And so there's already no political unity, and solutions have to be found now, before Turkey's accession, and not afterwards. It will be too late. And that's the big failure of the Nice Council, Nice Treaty, which did not sort out the issue of balance within the Council, within the Commission, within the Parliament. So basically, even now, the only solution to get out of the dilemma is to have Europe à la carte. And that's already the case. That has been the case for a long time. When you think of Europe, it is a kind of Europe à la carte. Not every European state has euro, only a few elected and selected members. Same for justice and home affairs issues, for example, the Schengen area. So that is probably a way of integrating Turkey. But furthermore, I'm not sure that there are only two visions of the European integration process. Probably even on the well, not talking even about Great Britain and its vision of the European Union as a market, as a free trade area, you have also within the continent different visions of the European Union. For example, you have the so-called small states such as Belgium or Luxembourg or the Netherlands, to a lesser extent, but especially Belgium, that are strongly in favor of a federal union. And on the contrary, France is strongly in favor of the Gaulle vision of Europe of member states, Europe of nations. So those are, all, are also different visions. And it's already quite difficult to find out a way to reconcile those visions.
Any question here, Burke?
Well, I mean, first of all, thank you so much for this very interesting and informative presentation. I think it was especially helpful for an American audience. Although I have to add, I find it a bit ironic that the question of Turkey membership, you discussed the chair that is reserved for the Turkish Presidential Board speaker is left empty. Sort of, it's very symbolic in the sense that it sort of captures the 50 years of Turkey-EU relations in that. In a very neat manner.
Not by design.
And of course, record, I don't like the guy, so I wasn't very unhappy. But, you know, of course, as much as Turkey's membership to the EU raises some questions about the EU overall and mirrors some of the problems, as you were rightly pointing out, it also mirrors some of the potential or actual problems of the Turkish political system. And I guess, you know, looking at the questions and then listening to some comments that people have been making, you know, we can sort of really capture what's going on in Turkey. I would actually like to follow the trend and make two short comments and then come up with my own question to sort of raise any issue. First of all, with regards to the Armenian genocide issue, as much as I sympathize with your position and certainly don't see the events as civil war, I think it's a terrible strategy to basically force Turkey to accept this as a precondition into becoming a member of the EU for basically three reasons. One, it weakens the hand of moderates in Turkey as we debate this issue. Two, I think one of the fundamental aspects of a democratic system is to accept and tolerate other viewpoints, however you might disagree with them or find them to be wrong or stupid. And then third, I think this raises an overall issue that most of the EU member states have gone through similar stages. So for example, will France recognize any Algerian genocide? Will the British recognize the Kenyan genocide? Or, you know, all sorts of other atrocious crimes that were committed by the European states. So, you know, I would like to put that on the table. With regards to the disfavorable American views among the Turkish electorate, although that is true, we have to keep in mind that this, I think, refers to the low approval ratings of the Bush administration within Turkey, which right now is, I think, around low 10%. But in this country, it's also low in the low 30s range. So I think the U.S. is sort of following along the Turkish electorate in that issue. Coming to my question, well, although, you know, people have sort of raised this issue with regards to Head Start, I'm curious as to how you perceive or how, let's say, European policymakers look at the AKP government, the Justice and Development Party, losing power for the last 5 years, simply because of the fact that I think that raises a critical question. What aspect of Turkey will EU would like to incorporate? Is it the Islamic Turkey, the pluralist Turkey, the democratic Turkey, or the nationalist Turkey? So this whole debate going on between the middle classes and the military versus the Islamist party is in power, reflecting some sort of a shift of power, is, I think, very interesting. So I'm curious as to how to look at that.
Thank you. We had already yesterday a debate on the genocide, so I will not... And including about French genocide in Algeria, so I will not speak about that, but I think basically we have to
share your
remain cautious about the word genocide, because it was designed for a very specific situation, which is the Holocaust. And it is, I mean, you cannot downplay the world. It's not possible. About the perception, the Brussels perceptions of the Turkish government, I think it has been evolving over time. And now the perceptions are quite positive, because the European Union found out that the Turkish government succeeded in leading a number of reforms. And you should have a look at the European Commission last report on progress report on Turkish accession, and it was quite positive about the government. Also, this is linked to the fact that the European Union is willing to incorporate the moderate part of Turkey, of course, and the democratic part. So it is, of course, much more willing to cope with democratic and even with the army than with an Islamic Turkey.
Mm-hmm. There are several more hands up. We have one over here and then a couple more in the middle. So let me go from here around this way.
I heard a UN delegate say that when Turkey enters the European Union, it will become an Islamic state. And I was wondering why they would say that. And then they said that it would be a disaster for all. I was wondering, why would it be a disaster for all?
Well, I don't know what he had in mind, but of course you can find different explanations. It would be a disaster for the European Union if no solution is found to the inefficient decision-making system. It will be maybe a disaster for Turkey also if Turkey feels not being accepted by the European citizens. And my feeling is that it would be a disaster if the European Union does not design a political vision of its own future and its own objectives. But you can easily find other explanations.
Here, yes.
I have a question about your use of the, when you say that a lot of Europeans fear a Muslim Europe. I think just to me that means that Muslim in Europe is mutually exclusive. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that point.
No, Muslim and Europe are certainly not mutually exclusive, because you must remember that Muslims once ruled parts of Europe, and that was obviously the case in Spain, for example, in the 8th or 9th century. That was the case in the Balkans. And that is still the case. And furthermore, there are important Muslim minorities in a number of member states, for example, in France, for example, in the United Kingdom, in Germany as well, and so on. So that was my point about religion not being a valid criterion for defining European identity. There is a Muslim Europe, there is of course a Christian Europe, but a Christian Catholic, a Christian Orthodox. There is also a Jewish Europe. So Europe is not linked to a specific religion, I think.
Yes.
You talked about the issue of, among some Europeans, there being fear of like immigration, fear of a Muslim Europe, and that issue could be especially poignant in France with the immigration riots they had recently. And yet, at the same time, I see that Sarkozy is kind of more open to the idea of Turkey joined the EU. So is there a disconnect between Sarkozy and the French people on the issue of Turkey joining the EU?
No. No, I don't think so. Because Sarkozy is currently setting up a hard line on immigration policy, allowing qualified people to get into to come to France and to get green cards and even citizenship. And that does not apply to Turkey. That is not targeted at Turkey, but rather as at Northern African or African states. So the flow of immigrants is a kind of irrational picture, a kind of irrational fear among EU citizens, and especially French or maybe German citizens. And that was already a fear of, for example, hordes or troops of Hungarians crossing the Danube and invading Paris. But of course, it did not take place.
The Polish plumbers never came. We will take two more questions, and then we'll call it a day. There was one hand up over here. And there are two of you. Maybe you can fight out which of you wants to ask the last question.
Germany has already experienced difficulties in integrating its Turkish population.
I cannot hear you. Sorry.
Germany has already experienced difficulties in integrating its Turkish population. And among the EU provisions for member states is a free movement of labor within the EU. Wouldn't the accession of Turkey most likely extend to such problems in the
Can you repeat just that sentence?
Wouldn't the accession of Turkey multiply the extent of such problems of integrating Turkey?
As always, the big issue stems from the lack of common policy. And that is the case for migration. There's no migration policy in the European Union. At the European level, there are only national policies. Turkey's accession is also an incentive for bringing together, at least approximating or, bringing to an equal level migration policies. And basically, that was also the case for other topics. When the EU faces external threats, be they rational or not, that is an incentive for upgrading policies and for making them at European level. And recently you could see that for the energy policy based upon the Russian threats to cut gas on Ukraine and so on. So Turkey again is reflecting the shortcomings of the European Union and the lack of common policy.
Final question. You haven't fought it out, have you? Well, I'll flip a coin and it'll be the gentleman who had the hand up a little bit longer.
Question one is, what happened to European Council? Question two is, I don't know how European Union works. Why can't they admit the members on a parts and parcel piece rather than wholesale, like agriculture, industry, pollution control, fishery, farming, immigration or passports?
Sorry, why cannot they admit members on specific issues?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, why can't they divide the membership into five or six parts and admit in parts and pieces?
That's how the accession negotiations are built. They are basically divided into 33 chapters, each corresponding to a specific sector. And until all conditions in all chapters are met, there is no accession. But if I understand you correctly, you would like a kind of in-between accession, accession for agriculture, accession for energy. That is not possible, because in that case there would be no coherence and no solidarity among members. For example, for energy you could have Slovakia and France, and agriculture you could have Poland and the UK. So there would be no longer any European Union, I think. And what happened to the European Council? What do you mean exactly?
Yeah, European Council.
You mean the Council of Europe? Or,
Council of Europe.
The Council of Europe is still alive. And it has 46 member states, among which, well, of course, members of the European Union, but also Russia, all former Soviet republics. And it is not considered to be an effective, a powerful institution. But at the same time, it is responsible for setting the rules in human rights-related areas. And to that extent, it serves as a basis for easy decisions when it comes to the political criteria of accession.
I would like to take the moderator's prerogative to thank Laura for making the long journey from Paris to Ithaca and telling us about the European Union and Turkey. So thanks very much, everyone, for coming. Thank you.